This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Ennio Morricone's spaghetti western soundtracks, Philadelphia soul, and hip-hop all influence the music of our guest, producer and composer Adrian Young. Today, he'll talk about two new albums he's produced and composed, one with rapper Ghostface Killah from the Wu-Tang Clan, and the other with William Hart, the lead singer of the Delfonics. On the new Delfonics album called Adrian Young Presents the Delfonics, Young wanted to combine the drama of the spaghetti western with the soul sound of the Delfonics. Before we listen to Terry's interview with Adrian Young, let's listen to a clip of the Delfonics' 1968 hit, La La Means I Love You.
Wasn't true, and you passed them by.
Passed them by.
Though you're in the center ring, and their lines don't mean a thing. Why don't you let me try?
Let me try.
Now I don't wear a diamond ring. I don't even know a song to sing. All I
That's the 1968 Delfonics hit, La La Means I Love You. Now let's hear how producer Adrian Young has combined the sound of spaghetti westerns and soul on the new song, Just Love, featuring Delfonics lead singer William Hart.
That's Just Love from the new album Adrian Young Presents the Delfonics. Adrian Young, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
I started with that track because to my ears it's the best illustration from the new album of how you've combined the soul sound and the Ennio Morricone spaghetti western, drama sound, with the chimes and the guitar and the buzzy instrument,
yes.
Whatever that is.
Fuzz guitar.
Why did you want to combine soul music and that Ennio Morricone kind of sound?
Well, to me, the Ennio Morricone kind of sound is a derivative of soul music. A lot of Ennio Morricone's music is just, it's very soulful, very cinematic, and very psychedelic. So the sounds that were used, like you said, the chimes, the bells, the fuzz guitar, it's something that is nostalgic and speaks to a listener in a different way. You don't usually hear those types of sounds in today's music. But when you hear those sounds, it takes you back to the music I like the best, organic music that is composed by real composers at a time when recording was at its height, which I believe is around, like, around 68 to 73.
So let's hear another track. I want to play Stop and Look and You Have Found Love, which is the single that's released from the album.
Yeah.
You know, the Delfonics had their hits in, what was the 70s?
60s and 70s, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, La La Means I Love You.
Ready or Not.
Yeah.
Here I Come. Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time? I mean, they had like 20 top 100 hits. I mean, they had a lot back then. You know, Somebody Loves You, Girl. I mean, all that.
And William Hart has a great falsetto, but he's 68 now, and there are very few 68-year-olds who still have a functioning falsetto.
Yeah, I know. He takes care of himself. He takes care of himself. But to answer the question of what this song is, basically when I was thinking about how I wanted this album to sound, I didn't want it to be a mere rehash of old 70s soul. I can't stand that. You know, to me, I wanted to go back in time. I wanted to go travel back in time to about 69, and I wanted to compete with the other soul groups that are out. So when me and William were sitting in the studio, these are things that we discussed, you know. And what I wanted to do was find a song that felt like Ready or Not, that had a sentiment, kind of a hip-hop flavor, funky. Timing is a little off, but there's a super warm groove in there and a message. Basically, I wanted to have something that had, that, like I said, mixed hip-hop, which is more 90s hip-hop, early 90s hip-hop, with early 70s soul. So Quincy Jones said something that I feel is very imperative to soul music, to modern soul music. He said, hip-hop mastered the drums, but hip-hop never really mastered composition, which I agree with 150,000,000%. Now, so that being said, I wanted the song to have a hip-hop sentiment as far as the drums are concerned. So the drums are a little raw and dirty, but still high in the mix. The bass line, I wanted the bass line to kind of be fat and warm as like a Curtis Mayfield track. And then the bells and whistles and all that, that's something that Ennio Morricone would have done. And also, I used something called a bell tree on here, a bell tree, and I mixed it with a timpani. And this is something that Tom Bell did, actually, on the Delfonics' first single, He Don't Really Love You. So I wanted to mesh all that together and try to form something new.
Okay, so this is Stop and Look from the new Adrian Young Presents the Delfonics album with William Hart singing lead. That's Stop and Look from the new album Adrian Young Presents the Delphonics, featuring the Delphonics' original lead singer, William Hart.
Yes.
And you know, I have to tell you, and don't take this the wrong way.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, as I said, William Hart's 68, and he's still singing in a falsetto, but I don't think he has, like, quite the control that he would have when he was, you know, decades younger.
Right.
And there's something about it that almost sounds like it's a vinyl pressing that was pressed something just like a little bit off center. So it's just like a little wavery, and it makes it sound like it makes it especially like ear catching and kind of odd.
Well, basically what I did, I mean, I have a, so my studio, let's just back up a little bit. My studio is fully analog. There's nothing modern. There's not even a computer in my studio. Everything's old. And, you know, old instruments, old Pro Audio. The mic that he's singing out of is an old ribbon mic. It's everything's old. So I record, and then when I'm mixing, I mix down in a way that they would have back then also, which is not, quote, perfect. With William, he's still a great singer. He doesn't sound exactly 100% like he did when he was younger, but he still sounds great. There's a modern there's a modern mature charm to what he's doing right now that I wanted to really capture and own on this album. So in doing that, I had to also balance the huge reverb that they used to use back then. And I panned a lot of it. And I also mixed this down to quarter-inch tape. That's what they used to do back in the day. So my quarter-inch tape machine is an old finicky machine as well. So that there's also a charm in hearing a mix that's mixed down to an old finicky quarter-inch tape machine that comes off at the end sounding somewhat strange yet interesting.
So you've said that one of your goals has been to produce a record that sounded like the Delphonics, produced by RZA, the producer of the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes.
And, you know, with Ennio Morricone mixed in. And now you've actually produced an album not only with William Hart of the Delphonics, but you've produed an album with Ghostface Killa, who is one of the Wu-Tang Clan. So how did that come about?
So RZA has a label called Soul Temple Records, and he started this with Bob Perry. So I'm at South by Southwest last year, and about a week before I went to South by Southwest, I was contacted on Facebook by Bob Perry saying, "Hey man, I love your music and would love for you to do a Wu-Tang oriented project." So at that moment I said, wow, one of my dreams, or another one of my dreams, is about to come into fruition. So I took about a week to develop a story. So this album is called Adrian Young Presents 12 Reasons to Die, starring the Ghostface Killer. And basically this is a score to a vintage Italian horror film, a faux vintage Italian horror film that takes place in 1968. So in my head, I pictured all this artwork, all this old Argento type artwork, and I wanted it to be something that Morricone would have scored back then. And then I wanted to pull in all of that Morricone sentiment, all of that old American soul sentiment. And then I wanted to kind of fabricate that in a way that the RZA would have put the album together had he been a producer in the late 60s. So that was my whole vision. So like with this whole thing with the Ghostface album, I wanted to create another world. You know, I tell people, I don't make music, I make worlds. And what I mean by that is that I'm not the guy that's going to make a single for somebody or make a single for somebody there. It's like, I want, when people are listening to my music, they're entering a world. You know, it's just like when I first heard King Crimson back in the day, you know, I mean, I entered their world. If somebody listened to the Beatles, you enter their world. So back to this Ghostface 12 Reasons to Die thing, you know, I put this Italian crime horror story together and close my eyes to really think about what the visuals would be. What would Ghostface Killer look like in this? You know, what would the characters look like in this? How do we enhance that with just audio?
So did Ghostface Killah come in and just lay his rhymes down over this elaborate scenario that you'd created, or do you feel like he got in the spirit of the story you'd created in your mind and the images that you created in your mind?
Okay, so basically, I'm a real control freak, big time control freak. So with this Ghostface album, I had some trepidation regarding what he wanted to bring to the story, because I respect the guy big time, you know, and I want to make sure that all of his thoughts and feelings were incorporated in this project that we mutually share. So what I did, if you see the artwork for the Ghostface Killah album, I shot all that stuff. And actually what I did is I bought a camera and bought a whole bunch of vintage lenses. And I spent about 2 months studying vintage photography, buying old vintage photography books, learning how they use their lenses, learning how they adjusted their lighting in order to be able to shoot these images that took me back to that time frame. And I put these photos together, and then I also put a script together, a full script with the 12 songs. I said, you know, in part one, you should be rapping from 103 to 145. And then this is what you should be talking about. This is what we need to talk about in this story, because it's a full story. So every song, he has something that he's supposed to elaborate upon. So when I put the script together, I gave it to Bob Perry and Andrew Kelly, the A&R. And they made their modifications to it and then submitted it to Ghost. And then Ghostface did all his recording, actually, in New York, and sent me everything.
So part of the lyric in the rap is, I'm a black vigilante killer. It's the almighty rise of the murderous Ghostface. Murder, murder,
yes.
Kill, kill, kill.
Yes.
Does that fit with your story, or does that sound like...
Yes.
Just,
no, it's not,
okay.
It's not ignorant black... like hip hop, like, oh, I got my gun, I'm gonna shoot it. No, it's nothing like that. It's very contextual. It's something like, this is a vintage Italian crime story. Okay, I'll say some of the story. So, Ghostface Killah historically has a character called Tony Starks. He uses this is one of his alter egos when he's doing albums. He's been doing this since the 90s, okay? So in my story, Tony Starks is a member of a white Italian crime family. He's the only black guy in there. And the Italian crime family, they're called the 12 DeLucas, okay? So he's the only black guy in the 12 DeLucas in the late 60s. And he's doing runs for them. He's doing hits. He's, you know, making them money. But because he's black, he can't rise in the ranks. So what he decides to do is start his own criminal faction against the 12 DeLucas. So a war ensues between them. And then he falls in love with one of the women of the 12 DeLucas. She betrays him, and then the 12 DeLucas kill him.
There's a reference in the opening of the track that we're going to hear, which is Rise of the Ghostface Killah, in which he refers to vinyl, and I know you're obsessed with vinyl records, so just explain that reference and then we'll hear it.
Okay. So that's RZA. So RZA is narrating the entire album.
Oh, okay.
Okay? So he does that at the beginning, and if you listen to that, or when we listen to it, you'll hear a choir going la 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 la. And basically what I wanted to do, I wanted to capture early 70s horror nostalgic element that I feel like has been lost in modern cinema. And basically it's that type of anti-Christy, The Omen, I'm, you know, good versus evil type thing. That's what this is supposed to be. So when we hear him making that reference, I'm trying to figure out if I should just tell this story right now.
No, just do the reference thing. It's because it's
well, he,
it sounds
okay,
to me like
well,
he's baking people into vinyl recordings, but
okay. Well, basically what happens. So you know what? I'm backing up. I'm letting it loose. I don't care. Let's go. Okay, I'm with Terry Gross right now. I'm gonna go. All right. So this is how it goes. Tony Starks fell in love with one of the women of the 12 DeLucas, and she lures him into a trap. And what happens is she invites him to an old record manufacturing plant in Italy. okay, to meet her. So he goes there, and the 12 DeLucas sabotage the meeting by killing his people and also killing him by burning him in a barrel of acetate. Acetate is what is used to make records. So when they burn him in this acetate, when they burn Tony Starks in this acetate, they make 12 vinyl records, 4 souvenirs of his death, to give to each one of the 12 DeLucas. And when these records are played, the spirit of the Ghostface Killer comes out to kill them all. So when you hear the song Murder, Murder, Kill, 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 and all that stuff, and I'm a Black Village vigilante, pro-violence, he's now Ghostface Killer coming back to kill all these people. So that's what this is. That's when Tony Starks becomes the Ghostface Killer.
Okay, and excuse me, I laughed in the middle of that. I know it's this big drama, but I think it's just hysterical the way you've managed to work your obsession with vinyl records into into this horror revenge story. Wonderful. Let's not put it off anymore.
Go for it.
So this is from the new Ghostface Killah album, and the album's called 12 Reasons to Die. It was composed and written and conceived by my guest, Adrian Young. La 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 la.
The DeLucas pressed Tony's remain into 12 vinyl records, one for each member of the family. But little did they know, he would return.
That's Rise of the Ghostface Killah from the Ghostface Killah album 12 Reasons to Die, which is set to be released April 16th. You'll find a longer version of the interview Terry Gross recorded with producer and composer Adrian Young on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Coming up, pets that glow, cyborg insects that function like surveillance drones, and pigs that serve as organ donors for humans. I'm not talking about a new sci-fi movie. These are all topics covered by our guest, Emily Anthus, in her new nonfiction book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. That's coming up on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Tegan and Sarah Quinn are identical twin sisters from Canada who have just released their 7th album. It's called Heartthrob, and the collection is a departure for the duo, whose music until now has often been categorized as indie or folk rock. Heartthrob is very much a faster-paced pop album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
All I want to get is a little bit closer. All I want to know is, can you come a little closer? Here comes the breath before we get a little bit closer. Here comes the rush before we touch. Come a little closer.
That's Closer, the first single from Tegan and Sarah's new album Heartthrob, and it pulses with an urgency that's propelled by the synthesizer keyboards of one of the album's producers, Greg Kurstin. The sisters' voices entwined to sing the catchy chorus with a soaring quality that would be airy and light were the words not so earthy and carnal. Closer is indeed a song about getting closer, emotionally and physically. It celebrates a one-on-one intimacy that extends to the way this duo is reaching out to what it hopes will be a larger audience.
I can't say that I'm sorry, getting so ahead of myself. I can't say that I'm sorry, for loving you and hating myself. I had nothing to show you, I had nothing to hold you down. It's killing me to walk away. How come you don't want me now? Why don't you wanna wake this up? How come you always leave me or never take my call? Fill me out. Why don't you wanna win me now? Why don't you wanna show me?
As openly gay women who've never made their sexuality or their sexual politics the subject of their material, Tegan and Sarah have always created romantic music about falling in love and living through relationships both good and bad. In the past, it was frequently possible to distinguish between the songs that each wrote. Tegan's were often tempestuous and fulsome, Sarah's more poppy. But the material on Heartthrob is very much a collaboration of sounds and sensibilities, and these women are united in expressing the joys and the agony, the often luxurious, languid agony, that anyone who's been in love can identify with. As in this very alluring, hurt-so-good ballad, I Was a Fool.
Do you remember I searched you all, how I climbed your city's walls?
I'm glad we live in a time when the idea of putting a glossy pop sheen on one's singer-songwriter pensées don't lead to accusations of selling out. Don't let your ears slip-slide over the surface of these tunes, because this is music that's often loaded with a carefully articulated sense of doubt or hopelessness that Tegan and Sarah suggest needs to be shaken off through a triumph of the pop music will. Tegan and Sarah wanted to expand their audience with a pop album, they certainly seem to have succeeded. Initial sales have been larger than any previous Tegan and Sarah album, and they're touring in larger arenas as an opening act for the Grammy-winning band Fun. But beyond commercial outreach, Heartthrob is the work of musicians interested in explaining, with lyrical precision arriving in billowing choruses, the small moments that make affairs of the heart both so specific and so universal. When you can convey both of these elements in a single song, you're really doing the good work of popular music.
Ken Tucker reviewed Tegan and Sarah's new album, Heartthrob. Coming up after a quick break, Emily Anthes talks about her new book, Frankenstein's Cat. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Goodbye, I don't wanna feel the need.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. If you think genetically modified foods have raised a lot of new questions, consider what's in the works with genetically modified animals. Researchers are altering the genetic makeup of some animals to learn more about what each gene is responsible for. Scientists are also implanting genes from one species to another to create, for example, animals whose milk has therapeutic qualities. Or a cat that glows in the presence of a black light because of a bit of jellyfish DNA in each of its cells. Scientists also are merging animal bodies and machines. Yes, there are now remote-controlled insects. These are the types of new creations that our guest, Emily Anthes, writes about in her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. She also writes about the new ethical questions posed by these creatures. Anthes is a science journalist who has been published in Wired, Scientific American, Slate, and the Boston Globe. She spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Emily Anthes, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you just run through some of the animals being genetically redesigned now, just some of the things going on in that world?
Scientists are re-engineering pretty much everything, and that starts from mice and rats in the laboratory. They're often being re-engineered to suffer from various diseases, ranging from cancer to diabetes to Alzheimer's. And scientists are doing this because they want to create lab rats and lab mice that they can use to study human diseases and potentially used to test cures for human diseases. So that's one area of research. There's also a area of research called farming, spelled with a PH, like pharmaceutical. And that is a discipline that involves re-engineering dairy animals. So goats or cows are the main animals used. And scientists can actually put genes in these animals that allow them to make human medicine in their milk. So you then milk, say, a genetically modified goat, and you process the milk, and suddenly you get some valuable human protein that can be used to treat all sorts of diseases. There are also things like gene therapy, which is being done to treat various animal diseases. So scientists have used gene therapy to cure blind dogs and give them the gift of sight. The list really goes on and on.
Okay, and let's go to the mutant mice being bred in China at a university there. And you say there's like 45,000 mouse cages. So from the research you've done, tell us what kind of mutants are being genetically bred in these 45,000 mouse cages.
Right, so the scientists in China are really taking an interesting approach. Traditionally, scientists have engineered animals by focusing on a specific gene first. Say they find a gene that controls cancer, they want to study cancer, they will tinker with it to create an animal that gets cancer. That's a slow and very deliberate process. The Chinese researchers have decided they want to speed up the creation of mutant mice. So what they're essentially doing is randomly disabling mouse genes one at a time. And they do this using what's called a jumping gene. And essentially they insert it or inject it into a mouse embryo. And the jumping gene jumps into a random place in the mouse's genome and disrupts a gene there. Then only when the mouse grows up and starts exhibiting various deformities do scientists really figure out what kind of gene they've disrupted. And so by doing this over and over and over again, they've created hundreds of different kinds of mutant mice. And there are mice that are prone to tumors. There are mice that get male pattern baldness. There are mice that have various behavioral abnormalities. One of them buries marbles endlessly. It sort of seems to be an OCD-like condition. There's a strange kind of mouse that only seems to be able to make left turns. And they're getting all these crazy mutants just by essentially throwing darts at a genetic dartboard and seeing what happens.
Can we mention the mouse with the tusk?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. There's a mouse that has tusks like an elephant might have. They're sort of anything you can imagine is being created. Ultimately, their goal is to create a database and a catalog of all these different kinds of mutant mice. So if a scientist wants to study, say, tusk formation in mice, they can order up this mutant and use it in their lab.
And for instance, if they wanted to study male pattern baldness, they'd know what the gene was and how you might be able to change that, or, you know, ditto for OCD or something like that. That's
correct.
Yeah.
And because the way that scientists are making these mice now or have made them in the past is a very slow and deliberate process. And a big part of the challenge is figuring out how to get the mouse that has the characteristics you want. So these researchers are trying to speed that up by, they want to randomly disable every single gene in the mouse genome and create a strain of mice for each one.
Let's take a look at the first pet that has had its genetics altered to make a more pleasing pet. And I'm thinking of the glowfish. You have glowfish. So just describe for those of us who haven't seen one yet what a glowfish does that's special.
So glowfish is the brand name. The fish are actually technically zebrafish. And they're little, small, tropical fish, and they're normally covered in just black and white horizontal stripes. They're native to Southeast Asia. Well, scientists have figured out a way to put special genes in the glowfish that code for fluorescent proteins. And so what happens is these fish's bodies churn out these proteins that essentially glow in the dark. So all of a sudden, you've taken fish that are normally just black and white, and you can create fish that are bright red, orange, green, purple. And they give off these bright colors under normal light, but if you put them under a blue or black light, they get especially bright. And so these fish are now widely available, sold for $5 or $6 a piece at Petco or Walmart, and they also come with a special glowfish tank that I also purchased, which has these blue and black lights, and you switch the lights on and you have these bright gleaming fish just swimming around in your living room.
Now this is an innovation for these fish. So what was done to these black and white striped zebrafish to make them glow all kinds of colors and glow even more in the dark?
So there are some species, particularly marine organisms, that naturally make these proteins. Jellyfish and sea coral and sea anemones have genes that let them fluoresce in the dark and in certain lighting conditions. So what scientists did was they took this fluorescence gene from a jellyfish, for instance, and they injected it into an embryo of the zebrafish. And what happens is just randomly, this fluorescence gene will integrate itself into the zebrafish genome. And when the zebrafish turns from an embryo into a fish, its body will start making the same bright proteins that jellyfish normally make. So you're taking a gene from one species and putting it into another species. And that's called transgenesis. And the result in this case is that these fish glow just like jellyfish might glow in the ocean.
If you're just joining us, my guest is science journalist Emily Anthus. We're talking about her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And it's about all the research being done with genetically modified animals and also with new biotechnology like prosthetics. One of the things in the works now is to help breed pigs so that their organs could be transplanted in human bodies without the human immune system rejecting the organ. And that's one of the biggest problems of transplants, is that the immune system knows that something foreign has entered the body and it does its best to fight it off, because that's what the immune system does. So can you describe a little bit what's being done with pigs so that and what organs are being used from pigs.
Right. Well, scientists used to focus on the potential for transplanting ape organs into humans. The idea was that apes were very similar to us, so that should work. But that idea has sort of become taboo, especially as we learn more about how cognitively sophisticated apes are. So scientists are now really focused on pigs, largely because their organs are about the same size as human organs. And there are already some very successful procedures being done. It's somewhat common now to receive a valve from a pig heart in certain heart operations. But scientists really want to be able to transplant whole organs, not just a heart valve from a pig, but say a whole pig heart into humans. There's a huge shortage of organ donors worldwide, and so scientists just imagine that if you could have these pig farms that are just growing organs constantly, it might save a lot of lives. The problem, as you point out, is rejection. And in the case of pig organs, the organs themselves are covered with these special sugars, and the sugars are only present on pig organs. Our own bodies don't have them. So as soon as you put the organ in the human body, our immune system immediately sees these foreign sugars and says, nope, that doesn't belong to us. We're going to attack it. And they attack the organ, and the patient's body rejects it. So the idea is to engineer pigs who don't have these sugars on the surface of their organs. And scientists have been able to do that so far. They basically disable the gene that codes for these special sugars, and the pigs grow up and they seem to be healthy. But these little clues that tip off our immune system that the organ comes from a pig are suddenly gone. So that's just a first step. Scientists haven't started putting these organs into humans yet, and there are other reasons our bodies might reject them, so there might be more that has to be done. But it just shows the potential of, if we can re-engineer an animal's body, we could potentially engineer it so it creates these perfect replacement parts for humans.
One of the things that I found both fascinating and kind of creepy and potentially frightening is that insects are being genetically modified. And it's almost like scientists are trying to turn insects into drones. Some drones are or will soon be insect-sized, but it sounds like some insects will soon have the surveillance capabilities of drones. And that's just too, like, insects are creepy enough when left alone.
And exactly.
Put surveillance technology in them and I'm out of here.
And actually, one of the engineers that's doing this work talked about this to me, and he said insects already have this sort of sci-fi quality. They have these strange foreign bodies, and then you add flying and surveillance and the military to that equation, and suddenly you have this recipe for dystopian fantasizing.
Absolutely. So tell us what's being done. Give us one example.
So DARPA is really interested in creating these flying insect
DARPA
cyborgs.
DARPA is the research arm of the Defense Department.
Yes, exactly. And so, as some listeners may know, there's been a lot of interest in drones, and especially creating very small drones that can fly unobtrusively into caves or buildings and sort of scope out the scene, see what's going on. The problem with creating totally robotic drones, especially very small ones, is that they need a source of power. And some engineers have built some very impressive tiny little flying machines, but usually they're so small and light that they can only carry enough battery power to really stay aloft for a few minutes. And so researchers realized that insects are small, they already know how to fly, and best of all, they power themselves. So if we could just take control over insect movements, we would already be halfway to these tiny little unmanned vehicles. So scientists have taken a few different approaches to this. One researcher at UC Berkeley is working with beetles, And he has created what is essentially a cyborg remote control beetle. He has a few wires that go into the beetle's brain and a few others that go into their wing muscles. And the wires snake out of these holes and all plug into a little circuit board that is mounted on the beetle's back. And this circuit board has a receiver and can receive signals wirelessly from the scientist's laptop. So essentially what they can do is they can sit in a room with their laptop and press a key and send a command to the beetle, and suddenly the beetle will take off. And as it flies around the room, they can overlay directional commands. They can send a message to the right or left wing that makes the beetle turn right or left. And when they're done, they can send another signal to the beetle that makes it stop flying and land on the ground. So they've really taken control of the beetle's movements and its nervous system.
So what are the possibilities of actually putting surveillance technology within an insect?
Right. So far, mostly what scientists have done is create these insects that we can steer. The next step would be to put various sensors on top of the insects. And by all accounts, that should be less challenging than the part that scientists have already done. Obviously, the equipment can't be very big or very heavy because the insects are not very big. But there are a lot of possibilities. One of the interesting applications might be, for instance, to put a little chemical sensor on this remote control beetle. And you might be able to then steer the beetle into a cave or a building. And the chemical sensor can tell you if anything inside the room it's in, for instance, is an explosive, and send that information back to the military or maybe soldiers who are thinking about entering that building. So you could get very useful information about the environment we're about to send our soldiers into.
So, Emily, you've called your book Frankenstein's Cat. Things didn't work out so well for Dr. Frankenstein and his monster.
That's true.
Are you implying that you don't think things are going to work out so well for this kind of experimentation, this kind of genetic experimentation that you're writing about?
No, we had a lot of discussions about the title, and one of those discussions was whether it gave the wrong impression. You'll also notice the subtitle includes the words cuddling up to biotech's brave new beasts. So I wanted to do a couple things. I certainly take these new powers seriously, and there's a lot of harm, absolutely, that we can do with genetic engineering and cyborg technology. But so often, only the risks are emphasized, and all that we see being discussed in the public sphere is how these things can go wrong. And so I wanted to try and balance the narrative a little bit by providing some examples of how things might go right. And I think regulation is important. I think proceeding carefully and cautiously is important. But what I really don't want to see happen is for general fear of biotechnology to prompt this knee-jerk reaction against all engineering or all cybernetics, because I think there are a lot of really good things that these technologies can do for animals and for humans. And if we have this knee-jerk reaction against the technology, then we lose the good as well as the bad.
Emily Anthes is the author of Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.